Excellent. Calling 85629, Kenneth Vaughn v. State. Counsel?
May it please the Court, my name is Catherine Curry-Diamond, and I represent Mr. Vaughn in this matter. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Vaughn's right to due process was violated in three distinct ways. First, Mr. Vaughn's conduct did not violate NRS 239.330. Second, the imposition of the habitual sentence must be reversed and remanded to have the issue presented to a jury in light of the United States Supreme Court pronouncement in Erlinger. And the restitution awarded in this case was improper and must be reversed. First, to the issue of NRS 239.330. Mr. Vaughn's conduct did not violate this statute because the documents he offered were not recordable, even if genuine. NRS 239.330 requires that a person knowingly offer a false or forged instrument for recording that, if genuine, might be recorded. None of the documents offered by Mr. Vaughn were recordable documents. There's no law of the state of Nevada or in the United States that allows for the recording of documents from Moorish National Republic federal government. The County Records Administration Manager, Courtney Hill, testified as much. The state asked Mr. Hill over and over and over again about, in his initial direct examination, about whether or not any of the documents that Mr. Vaughn submitted were recordable. And his answer over and over and over again was no, they are not recordable documents. When we look at what the instrument, if genuine, means under 239.330, it has not been pronounced by this court or interpreted by this court. This is a statute that we enacted out of the crime and punishment legislation in 1911, and it's an adoption of the exact California statute that they adopted in 1872. So although our court has not interpreted the statute and what instrument, if genuine, means, the California court have interpreted that term. What the California court discussed is that a common definition of an instrument is one that is drawn up and executed in technical form as to be of legal validity. None of the documents that Mr. Vaughn presented were drawn up in technical form as to present as legally valid. The California Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court have gone on to say that a crime is completed when the deed has been prepared so that upon its face, it will have the effect of defrauding one who acts upon it as genuine. So where the deed appears valid on its face, that is when a violation or an instrument appears valid on its face, that is when a violation of NRS 239.330 occurs. And none of the documents that Mr. Vaughn offered for recording in this case were valid on its face or even appeared to be valid on its face. This is a point that the state concedes in its responsive briefing. It says an ordinary person would understand that the instruments from a fictitious government are not genuine. So we all agree that these are not genuine documents because the Moorish federal national government is not a legal entity. It has no legal authority. Beyond just California, the Supreme Court of Washington has also interpreted a very similar, almost identical statute. And in the Supreme Court of Washington has discussed how a document is required to be falling within the scope of state law, the content of the document must be scrutinized for materiality, and importantly, there has to be a likelihood that the extent of others rely on the document. The Court of Appeals out of New York also held similarly in a very similar statute, that the purpose of these statutes is to guard against the possibility that officers of the state or its political subdivisions would act upon the false document. Nothing that Mr. Vaughn presented would induce another person to act upon it. It never appeared valid on its face. And Mr. Hill testifies to this extent. Mr. Hill says, as long as we recognize the format, it will be recorded. Again, this is if the document presents itself out to be valid, if it presents itself to come from a legitimate legal source, if it presents itself to be a legally valid document with legal authority, and it's properly formatted, and it appears valid, we will record it. But none of the documents that Mr. Vaughn presented in this case met any of those requirements and did not meet any requirements under NRS 239.330 for genuineness.
Does the default judgment, so to speak, present a closer case?
So the default judgment in this case is just that he presented is one that is just titled default judgment. So if you're looking at the document and what it actually says, and I believe it's the affidavit of fact notice of default judgment, it discusses that there's just no jurisdiction over him and that the state's and all the state's claims of misrepresented attainders against him aren't hereby expunged. So, and he sends this document to the Metropolitan Police Department. And so when we're looking at not just the title, but what the contents of the document are, they're not valid in or could be genuine in any way, not in its substance and not in its form and not in its title. Mr. Hill also testifies that a notice of default judgment, if it comes from the court, would be recordable, which is an analysis that's important when we're talking about writs of repossession, decrees, judgment, notice of default. That is part of the analysis for the recorder's office is, what is the source of this document? Beyond that, Mr. Vaughn's conduct could not have violated NRS 239.330. The awarding of restitution in this case was improper. Restitution must be awarded when it's proven by reliable and accurate.
Can I have you just back up just a tad and address counts 1 and 10 under 207.337?
Yes.
Stimulation of summons, complaint, judgment, or other legal process.
Yes, Your Honor. So, Your Honor, he has to have under 207.337 the simulation of summons, complaint, judgment, or order, or other legal process. He has to induce the other person or have the intent to induce the other person to for a payment of a claim or induce the other person to submit to the putative authority of the document or to take action or refrain from taking any action in response to or the basis of the document or to comply with the document. So, again, these documents that he sends to the McMurrays, in this case, and the three-day notice that he posts on the door, don't purport to, he, again, makes them out to be from the Moorish federal national government, which, again, is not a legitimate legal authority, right? So it's not as though he's posting these notices as if they are coming from the 8th Judicial District Court, or that they are coming from some legally valid source that would induce a person to act on it or potentially refrain from acting upon it or have to hire an attorney to fight it. So, again, these documents are on their face, just not valid.
But he presented them with the intent to induce payment and get something that he wasn't entitled to. And I think your argument below was that he thought he had the authority pursuant to his Moorish government status.
Yes.
And so that's basically what you're looking at in defense of this claim, right?
Yes. Okay. That he believed it to be legitimate legal authority even though it wasn't. So if he's believing it to be legitimate legal authority, you know, it's not simulation for him, right? But there's no intent to deceive from his perspective or from his intent because he believes it to be a legally valid document.
But his intent was to induce them to submit to the authority of that document.
His intent was to post the 3-day notice, and I think he comes to the house to talk to them about how they've been defrauded into purchasing the home.
Okay.
So, Your Honors, when we talk about the remaining issues in this case, the restitution order in this case was wholly improper because the restitution award requires that a defendant be found guilty of a crime relating to the restitution, that he admit to the restitution, or that he agree to pay the restitution. And none of that occurred in this case.
Did he object?
He said the word lies when there was a discussion about restitution and what restitution would be ordered. So although he doesn't say the word objection, you know, there's no magic phrase, but he is objecting to the court in that he's communicating to the court that the restitution is a lie. So the restitution is, one, doesn't match the testimony that was given at trial, and two, there was no supporting documentation. When the court asks the state specifically, do you have any documentation to support this, the state says, no, we asked the victims, and the victims did not provide any. So the restitution order, I believe, has to be reversed and remanded in order for that order to be vacated. Finally, Your Honor, under the habitual offender and Erlinger decision, we request that the matter be reversed and remanded so that a jury can make the decision as to whether or not he achieved habitual status beyond a reasonable doubt. That case came out after briefing was concluded in this case, and it came out after Mr. Vaughn had already been sentenced. But the Supreme Court is very clear that the Fifth and Sixth Amendment do require that any fact that increases a sentence must go to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt.
Isn't that statute significantly different than our habitual criminal statute in the sense that the judge is finding the fact of a conviction or a number of convictions as opposed to all the other factors that Erlinger is requiring?
Well, in the Erlinger case, they talk about how prior convictions and whether or not they arose out of the same occurrence is a fact.
Violent, and there's several other factors to consider that are factual in nature that should be determined by a jury, right?
Yes. But in our...
We don't have that in this case. It's a fact of a conviction, and we've spoken on that previously.
Yes, Your Honor, but in our case, right, the state did offer a conviction from California and two convictions out of Missouri, one of them being an escape conviction. And whether or not, even though they had separate conviction dates, whether or not those arose out of the same transaction or occurrence still has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, because that would be a fact of whether or not the conviction was prior and whether or not it arose out of the same transaction or occurrence. I would like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
All right. Madam Clerk, if you add a minute to this gentleman, we'll add a minute to the rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Austin Beaumont, and I'm here representing the state of Nevada. So specifically, as to the recordable, even if genuine, arguments from appellate, Mr. Hill testified on redirect, to the best of my recollection, that these documents that we charged in the complaint were all recordable if they were genuine. The genuine analysis goes to the substance of what is put forth to be recorded, not the titling of what's put forth to be recorded. And the cases that were cited by appellant in the appellant's brief, or in the opening brief, talk about patents, for example, out of California, a much older case where patent letters were submitted for recordation, and because the substance of those patent letters is not something that could be recorded in the recorder's office, that was not something that gave rise to violation of that identical criminal statute. Here, there were a number of other documents that Mr. Vaughn filed with the recorder's office that we did not charge. For example, his vaccination records. And there's no doubt, there's no argument as to whether Mr. Vaughn's vaccination records are something that could be properly recorded. So that's why those specific filings were not charged. However, each one of the charged offenses involved some sort of claim to title, a judgment, a writ of possession, my apologies, a UCC financing statement, property repossession notices. All of those counterparts have specific filing ability with the county recorder's office, according to Mr. Hill. So if Mr. Vaughn had filed, say, the standard notices of writs of possession or property repossession or the default judgments that ordinarily come before the recorders, those would have been genuine documents. Ultimately, in this case, the recorder's office didn't file them because of formatting issues. So formatting issues including the size of the paper that they were printed on, the font, the titling that appellant references.
But going to the nature of the document themselves, an affidavit of clear, perfect, LOA land title, what does that look like and what does it do? I think in part of your argument, you're saying there's something parallel that can be comparative to make it recordable. Why would that be recordable? It's not recognized as any document that's recordable.
Because the titling of that document, the Moorish National Citizenry regarding a loyal title and the various different titles that he gave to the documents he recorded, that goes to the formatting of the document as to whether that can be properly formatted. That title doesn't match the formatting requirements of the office, and that's why it wasn't recorded. But the substance of that document, as Mr. Vaughn testified to in trial, was put simply, this is my property, and I am now recording that I am taking it from you and putting it in my possession. All of those documents shared the similarity of the underlying purpose to the filing. So that's why each one of the documents, regardless of the title, goes to the genuineness of those articles. And again, while Mr. Hill originally said that the titles of these documents are not things that could be recorded, the substance of them, being transfers of title, are recordable. And when they are recordable, they do have certain formatting requirements. Unfortunately, these didn't have those formatting requirements, but that doesn't mean that the substance of those requirements, making them genuine, takes them out of the ambit of this particular criminal statute.
Okay.
And again, there's no requirement, as posited by the appellant, that someone actually relies upon the document. The crime is complete when the document is offered for recordation. Ordinarily, this isn't something that the recorder's office could catch up front as to whether it was genuine or not, because as Mr. Hill testified, that's not within their authority. That's not within their policing power. They don't record, they don't determine whether, for example, a mechanic's lien is true or not as to whether the mechanic's lien is proper before it is recorded. They simply record it, and then after the fact, if it's determined to be not genuine, then that's when the crime effectively is found. And regarding the service of summons, again, this goes hand in hand with Mr. Vaughn's purpose in filing all of these documents. He was serving those summons notices to the different victim families in this case to induce them to do something, which was give me your property because I have title based on whatever Moorish National analysis that he was coming to on his own. And then after telling them that he was going to be taking their property, 3-day notices to quit and so on, he then recorded what he believed to be genuine documents based on his ideology to then possess that land from them. And it's not about intent to deceive, it's about his intent to have them submit to the authority of the document. So throughout these documents, he is quite convinced of their genuineness, of their authority. He's acting with the intent to have them submit to those documents, and he's acting with the intent to record them so that ultimately he could rely upon them later and take that land from them.
Mr. Beaumont, will you address the intimidating public officer? Are those the nature of comments, you know, how those actually fit into the statute? I mean, I'd imagine clerk's offices field these types of comments on the regular.
And thank you, Your Honor. Under, on the regular, Ms. Conway, the elected official from the recorder's office, testified that she'd never encountered something like this before. This was something that terrified her. ordinarily in these sort of cases where we have intimidating public officers, it's an employee of the office who's being threatened in the office, but Ms. Conway herself was receiving these threats, and Ms. Nario herself was receiving these threats from Mr. Vaughn, wherein he was enraged that he was not having these documents recorded as he requested them, because he was very clear in his intent to have these recorded so that these could be relied upon. And when they told him that they were rejected, that was when he threatened to send the army down there. That was when he threatened to take action against them in very specific ways. And that was what the intimidation counts were based on, was because of his frustration and anger directed directly at Ms. Conway and at Ms. Nario, over the phone to Ms. Nario and over letters, if I remember correctly, to Ms. Conway. In the restitution, Mr. Vaughn stated very generally that things were full of lies, if I'm quoting him correctly, that the witnesses who testified against him were full of lies. So to apply that generally to the restitution amount, he never made any sort of specific objections to the amounts of the restitution. And within...
Well, and again, he's acting pro se.
Yes.
And he's objecting to the fact that... there was a true indication of the restitution that he would be required to pay. And it's all lies. And I understand he didn't look at the PSI. He wouldn't look at it. But in any event, it seems to me like he's objecting to that. And then getting to the restitution, I've got issues with the way that was presented, why those numbers, the 7,200 and the 90 whatever was awarded, the difference there as to the actual amount. I just have an issue with the restitution.
So as far as the restitution goes, the basis of several of these felonies against Mr. Vaughn was at some point in March of 2020, he stopped paying rent, which was testified to be $800 a month, and he didn't pay rent from March of 2020 until December of 2020, and I may be wrong on the year. My apologies if I am. But that adds up to 9 or 10 months worth of rent that he was not paying. So the testimony is there, and there is competent evidence within the record to base the rental amounts upon. That was submitted with the PSI. The additional amounts regarding the security deposit.
But we don't have, excuse me, we do not have the PSI. Your brief makes mention that you're going to file a motion to transmit it, but I don't see that motion of record. Nor did I see the PSI, and we looked for it.
My apologies, Your Honor. I was not aware that the PSI did not make it into the record.
Yeah, it didn't make it.
But without the PSI, what supports the restitution in the amounts assigned, including especially the $10,000 in damages?
The $10,000 in damages, to the best of my recollection, was Mr. McMurray had testified that Mr. Vaughn had damaged the apartment while he was living there, and that the specific amounts that we were talking about at trial were about the monthly rentals, or the monthly rental amounts that he was not making. So that was the $800 a month times however many months it was, 9 or 10, that he stopped paying rent once he started filing all of these documents to possess that property and then ultimately not have to pay them the rent.
So, counsel, the $10,000 was not supported by receipts, correct?
Correct. There were no receipts supported for that. Regarding the restitution as well, if it would be remanded for potentially a hearing or more receipt evidence on the damages to the apartment, that would be a suggestion from the state. But regarding the habitual offender argument under the ACCA, it's simply not applicable here. It's not under the Armed Career Criminal Act. This is a habitual sentence that was levied after only examining the number of prior convictions under our statute. There are a number of different cases that support that if the sentencing judge is only looking at the number of prior convictions, that is not something that has to be submitted to a jury to be found beyond a reasonable doubt. It's only when there are additional factors that need to be submitted to a jury, such as type of offenses, use of violence, risk of physical injury, drug offenses, ages of victims, and so on. Those sorts of issues where enhancements are created by the sentencing judge, that would be something that would be proper to give back to the jury. But here, there are a number of cases. In fact, one of the cases that was cited by appellant states that the court has reiterated the limit on the scope of the Almendez-Torres over and over to the point of downright tedium regarding whether a judge can or cannot enhance a habitual sentence based purely on the number of convictions, and courts are routinely held that it can.
Well, the court finding on the number, that the fact of conviction, does the date of that conviction fall under the ability of the court to do it without a jury? Because that's the issue, is not the fact of conviction, I think. The question is when those convictions occurred.
Whether it was when the convictions occurred, my recollection under these cases is that if it is simply the number of convictions that a court is looking at, the date is not relevant as to whether the habitual state or whether the habitual enhancement can be applied. It's merely the number of convictions. So I did not find a case wherein the specific dates had to be found by the judge. Here, however, Mr. Vaughn's cases were, I believe he had a total of 8. Ultimately, we were able to obtain JOCs from 5 of those, and that's why he received the small habitual statement or small habitual sentence. As far as remanding for the different dates, again, I found nothing under Erlinger or involving with Almendarez-Torres that indicates that the jury would have to find that these offenses were committed on separate dates. It's only whether there are prior convictions, and that is within the ambit of the sentencing judge. Additionally, the jury instruction, the court did not abuse its discretion by giving jury instruction number 12. This was what effectively became a hybrid instruction of the state's proposed instructions, wherein regardless of an individual's claimed status of descent, be as a sovereign citizen, secured party creditor, or a flesh and blood human being, that person is not beyond the jurisdiction of the courts. These theories should be rejected summarily, however they are presented, from the Benabe case in the Seventh Circuit that was cited in our response. Judge Johnson decided to put the gist of that instruction within the middle of the ignorance of the law is not a defense instruction, because Mr. Vaughn's sovereign citizen slash Moorish beliefs were directly at issue here. So his entire legal defense was, I don't believe the law applies to me, and therefore I should not be held accountable for these crimes. But at best, that's jury nullification. At worst, it's a complete misstatement of the law. So if that is something that is going to be at issue at trial, it is something that needs to be explained a little bit more to the jury so that they can understand that choosing not to comply with the laws of the United States or Nevada is not a valid legal defense in any situation. Additionally, just to reply to the statements by Detective Mead, there are a number of times that are stated in the appellant brief that Detective Mead directly testified as to Mr. Vaughn's intent. That is not supported by the record. Those statements are not cited to in any way. Detective Mead never actually stated that Mr. Vaughn was guilty or that he acted with the intent to commit the charged offenses. He was asked generally about Moorish beliefs. He answered generally about Moorish beliefs, and then Mr. Vaughn followed up with Detective Mead about those beliefs and echoed them himself. So if there was any issue about that, Mr. Vaughn adopted all of those statements by Detective Mead and stated throughout trial his belief system. So there's no prejudice as to Mr. Vaughn for those questions. At best, it is harmless error. My apologies to try to hit every one of the issues on appeal. And as far as the motion to dismiss the indictment goes, none of the factors of Barker are really met here. The delays that were caused totaled only 4 months, far less than the year required for presumptive prejudice. The majority of the time that were delayed were either directly due to Mr. Vaughn's being in competency or requesting continuances of the trial on his own due to his inability to prepare prior to the first trial. I believe it was 9 days that he said he was in the hole. There's no prejudice. He lost no witnesses. He testified at length on his own. He admitted to every one of the elements of every one of the offenses while on the stand. And eventually, at one point during the first trial sitting, he did waive his right to a speedy trial specifically. So as to the third marker factor of whether the defendant asserted his rights, he simply did not assert his rights to a speedy trial after the first trial sitting. He waived them. So at this point, there would be no prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, we added a minute to your response.
Thank you, Your Honor. So a couple points in rebuttal here. When Mr. Hill testifies about the transfers of title, he talks about how there has to be signatures between parties. There's notaries involved. There are values of property assessed. There are a lot of requirements that go into these documents when we're talking about property title and transfer of those properties. And again, when we're looking at what all of the case law and all of the interpretations have come about NRS 239.330 and similar statutes, it's that upon its face it will have the effect of defrauding one who acts upon it as genuine. So that's really what we're looking at. Is someone going to look at this document and think it to be an actual transfer of title? And the answer is no. And according to state, if we accept the state's proposition, I can write on this piece of paper right now, I am now the owner of Mr. Beaumont's house, and then go to the recorder's office and try to file it, and now I have committed a Category C felony. That's just not what if genuine means. And courts have time and time again interpreted it not to mean that, that it has to appear legitimate on its face. Additionally, Your Honor, when we're talking about the habitual eligibility in Erlinger, those were the exact facts of Erlinger. Were these crimes arising out of the same transaction, or were they separate and distinct? And that is what the issue was in Erlinger. And that's why any fact that increases the sentence has to go to a jury, because we're looking at...
But where it was whether they arise out of the same transaction necessarily required the judge to go behind, or somebody to go behind the conviction to suss that out.
I believe it does, Your Honor.
If you just have a JOC that has a date of offense, you're saying the judge may find, yeah, you were convicted, but the jury has to decide what date? Not whether they arise out of the same factual transaction, but the date on the JOC. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor. So I think it's whether or not they, as to Erlinger's point, right, whether or not it actually occurs on separate occasions, and whether or not those convictions are one and the same out of the same criminal transaction, or if they're separate and distinct from one another. So the fact of a prior conviction is not enough, because we have to look at whether or not they're separate from one another in addition to the prior conviction. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, counsel. Justice Pickering, did you have anything further? It's because you're remote. I don't want to not give you your chance. All right.